I was in Corinth, Greece, last year, and some of you are going to go with me in November as I return to Rome and to Corinth and Ephesus, the places that to which Paul wrote in these New Testament letters that we have. I'd love to have some of you, maybe most of you, all of you, go with me on that trip next November. But one of the things you realize in visiting a place like Corinth was it was a tough appointment. It was a rowdy port town with a huge mix of people in it. You had the wife of the chief Roman financial officer for the third largest city in the Roman Empire in that church, and probably 80% of the people in that church were slaves, many of whom were enforced prostitutes for the pagan gods in that city of sailors. And so you had this incredible mix of people, the highest classes and the lowest classes, people from all kinds of backgrounds in that church in Corinth. And Paul, who has a special place in his heart for the people of Corinth, writes them several letters. We know of at least three letters he wrote them. We have two letters that survive. And I want to share with you just the parts of the fifth chapter of the second letter to the Corinthians. From now on, therefore, we regard no one from a human point of view. Even though we once knew Christ from a human point of view, we know him no longer in that way. If anyone is in Christ, there is a new creation. Everything old has passed away. See, everything has become new. All this is from God, who reconciled us to himself through Christ and has given us the ministry of reconciliation. That is, in Christ, God was reconciling the world to himself, not counting their trespasses against them, and entrusting the message of reconciliation to us. So we are ambassadors for Christ. Since God is making his appeal through us, we entreat you on behalf of Christ, be reconciled to God. And so I looked up the meaning of reconciliation. It's to bring, as if I didn't know it, but I wanted to make sure I knew it. Some of the things I know, it turns out, I don't know. Reconciliation means to bring together two individuals or groups who've been at odds, who've seen things very differently, and to bring them together. And the second meaning is to take two seemingly contradictory truths or statements or positions and help discover the commonalities and the connections in them. Not to wipe out one in favor of the other, but to bring them together. And I think as I look back, that may be a part of the meaning of my ministry and the ministry of this church. I celebrate the fact that this is a very, in some respects, it's not a very diverse church. I mean, look around. Everybody's got gray hair. Everybody's white and got gray hair, pretty much, you know. But at a deeper level, we got people from so many different religious backgrounds here and so many different political and theological perspectives. In trying to describe this church to Peter, I said, well, you know, you can't really label it. It's an open-minded congregation. I wouldn't call it liberal or conservative. It's got a little bit of everything in it. And that's good. I think that's the way the kingdom of heaven is, that you've got people with very different backgrounds and perspectives and ideas, and not trying to do away with their viewpoints, but to see where do we connect? Where can we reconcile? Where can we work together? That's very Wesleyan. John Wesley, the founder of the Methodist movement, said, you know, on things that aren't absolutely critical to our faith, let's agree to disagree, but work together. And I think this church is very gifted at doing that. And so that's been an important part of my ministry here. I'm wearing a shirt that the church gave me. It's a Tommy Bahama silk shirt. I thank you for it. And it has my name on it, in case I forget my name tag, Bob Brown. It has a 34 on it. But don't be misled by that. I've been here 34 years, but I've been a minister for 44 years. I just look incredibly young and vigorous. It's easy to be misled on that. I was ordained a United Methodist minister when I was 22. I was called to the ministry when I was 6. And went straight through high school, college, seminary. Was ordained when I was 22. And began serving my first church when I was 3 weeks past my 24th birthday when I started serving my first church, Wesley United Methodist Church in West Melbourne, Florida, which is the Samsula of Brevard County was at that time. don't laugh, you should have seen it. But I love that church, and I loved it so much that a few years into that stay at Wesley, when our first son was born, we named him Wesley for that church, and we'll always be grateful to them. So I've learned lessons in 3 churches that I've served now, 5.5 years at Wesley, 3 years at Highlands in Jacksonville, and now 34 years here. And so I've tried to reflect on some of the lessons I've learned in that time, and especially from you, all under the gun from Staff Parish that says, you know, make it brief, we got stuff to do today. So, but I didn't learn a whole lot, so it won't take too long. First thing to tell you, in case you didn't know this, ministers are not trained in anything useful. 4 years of college, 3 years of seminary, and I don't think I learned a single thing in seminary that was directly useful to actually being the pastor of a church. I learned a little bit of theology and Bible, but nothing about how to balance a budget, how to organize a committee, nothing about building programs, nothing that actually, I mean, people care a lot more about the color of the restroom stalls than they do about Pauline theology. So I learned nothing useful, so everything I know that's useful in a church, I learned by trial and error. I tried to learn along the way, went to seminars and workshops and all that, but basically, you do it by trial and error, and I will forever be grateful to the members of these 3 churches, especially you, because you've had to put up with me the longest, for putting up with me learning by trial and error. I got an early cue that it wasn't going to be easy. The first day in the parsonage of our first church, 24 and 22 years old, first day, so excited to be in my first church, 5 o'clock in the afternoon, we're still putting stuff away from the moving van, and a knock at the door, and a couple stood there, and they came in, and they said, "We just wanted you to know that your sermon Sunday will determine whether we stay in the church or not." And thank God, Monday they left. But that was a clue that church people are neither better nor worse than people outside of church. They really aren't. They're not better, they're not worse. They're people. And you have wonderful experiences with people in church, and you have some terrible experiences with people in church. The difference is the church is consciously trying, often failing, but trying to point towards something beyond themselves, toward God. And that's the main difference. That's the main difference. I've met some very bigoted and little people in church, and some very generous and loving people outside of church. But I've been called to be a pastor of a United Methodist Church, and I have seen so much love, so much caring and openness and sacrifice by people in church. And I think that church is the place, church is the gathering of people that can point beyond ourselves to that which is greater. So what did I learn? Well, I learned, for one thing, how little I knew. I learned that you can learn things you don't know. When I was ready to move from my second church, which wasn't too long after I got there, I told the district superintendent three things. I said, I want to move to a church in a university town. I want to go to a church with a lot of youth in it, because most of my ministry had been involved with youth. And I reiterated what I had said when I first was ordained to the Methodist Church, that I never wanted to go to a church with a building program. And here I am. And no noticeable universities located near us. When I came here, one of the written goals of this church was to attract more youth, and knowing that that can vary, I asked, Joan Harvey was in that committee, and Bernice Gross, and one, either you or Bernice Gross said to me, I said, what's the definition of youth? Because it varies. And they said, people under 65. And this church was in the early stages of a building program to replace a building that had been built in 1904. So I wanted to work with college students and youth, and I didn't want to be in a building program, and I've had the exact opposite on all three counts ever since. So I had to learn that what you need to do is not necessarily what you would choose to do. And I enjoyed so much working with people that were literally three times my age. I was 32 when I came here, and there were lots of people in the church that were 96, or at least they looked like they were. And it was great, because I was everybody's grandson. You know, it was just really nice. I had a lot of elderly people in the church, and what's been shocking to me the last year or two is to realize that some of those elderly people are still here, and then I do the math and realize that they were 10 years younger than I am now when they were elderly people here. So I've learned something about mortality and humanity. But I've learned how patient churches can be as you try to learn. And I've had to learn a lot about church. I went through this building campaign, the campaign to build the addition we had over there. We bought 26 parcels of land in the time I've been here. That was not on my list of things I wanted to learn how to do. 26 parcels of land, 50-foot lot by 50-foot lot to make this campus possible and make our ministry possible. I never wanted to learn how to do that. But I learned because of you, because this church was one of the few churches around that said it wanted to grow and actually meant it, was willing to make the sacrifices to grow and to reach out. And I'm forever grateful for that. One of the things I've learned through the years is that God has this strange sense of humor and plays practical jokes on people. I, along with probably the majority of ministers, am an introvert. And I keep discovering just how much of an introvert I am. And we are called by God into a job that requires an extrovert. It is a challenge. When Becky and I were growing up, both her dad and mine are United Methodist ministers, and we grew up in the system where every 3 or 4 years you moved. And the way it worked was, our dads would go off to annual conference, usually in Lakeland, and on Friday, they would find out whether they were moving or not. They'd come back, preach on Sunday, and the following Thursday, we were living in a new city with a new church. That's the way it worked. It was no transition process. You just moved. And I realized that's what my personality was meant for. It's hard saying goodbye. It is hard to be here this morning. I announced on January 11th that I would be retiring. So it's been 5 months now of saying goodbye. And frankly, I'd rather just, you know, be here one Sunday and gone the next, because it's hard to relate to hundreds of people. And yet I was called to this ministry, and so that's what I do, and I love it. I always love it when I do it. I love being around people. I love working with people. I love you in groups and individually. But as many of you know, I would, you know, my first choice is always to sit in the recliner with my remote control and a jar of peanut butter. If I can't do that, then, you know, I'll do something else. But I've learned that I am an introvert, but for the sake of God's calling, I can be an extrovert. Paul said, I've learned to be all things to all people. And maybe that's what he meant. I don't know. I've come to realize over the years that I'm not a religious person. And we've been a good match because this is not a very religious church. And it's true. Y'all are a bunch of, for the most part, a bunch of Yankees. And Yankees are not terribly religious. Hey, my dad's from Boston. I understand. Another way of putting it is nobody would ever confuse this for a Bible Belt church. True. Yeah, that's true. What do I mean by all that? We don't necessarily overtly have a lot of prayer groups, not a lot of Bible studies. We don't begin every meeting with 15 minutes of prayer and Bible study, although the two occasions in 34 years we tried that, it was very good. Some of you, I hope, know I'm kidding a little bit. But the reason for it is this. I've come to realize the truth of the old Roman saying that was picked up by Carl Jung by way of Erasmus in the Middle Ages. A Latin saying which translated is, invoked or not, God is present. You don't have to have an invocation. You don't have to have hours of prayer and Bible study. You don't have to say Jesus every 3 minutes or every 30 seconds for God to be present. Whether we invoke God or not, whether we invite God or not, God is present in everything. And so, to me, there is a there is no difference between the religious and the secular, or as in theological language, no difference between the sacred and the profane. You know, it's like, well, church is religious and sacred and holy, and then what happens on Flagler Avenue is, well, we know what happens on Flagler Avenue. But no, there's no difference. It is all one. God is present in everything we do, in every person, in all our institutions. God is present. Whether we invite God or not, God's there. God is Yahweh, the Hebrew word. God is that which is. God is the verb I am. I am. This is the reality. This is the existence. This is the truth behind it all. God is, and God is in all things. So, if I don't always start a meeting with a prayer, I never start a meeting without believing God's present. The prayer is really for us to remind us that God's there. It's not to get God's attention. Hey, God, we're meeting now. Would you please be here? No, I say, hey, God is here, you know. So if we have a prayer, it's for us, it's not for God. To remind us that God is present. And in all things we do, God is present. Just as much on Flagler Avenue on Saturday night as in this church at 10 o'clock Sunday morning. God is present. There is no distinction, there's no difference. And part of that, I realize, is this emphasis for me is to realize that I am, I hate to say the word, I'm a mystic. It's taken me 60 plus years to realize that. I do not experience God primarily in a Bible study. I do not experience God primarily in a prayer group. I do not experience God in the ways that most Christians experience God. I like to think that I experience God more like Moses did. Like every 20, 30 years, you see God face to face and you're changed, and then you wait another 30 years and you see God again. Moses, minding his own business, sees a burning bush in a mountain, climbs the mountain, and finds himself face to face with God. And he and human history are changed by that event. And he goes back down and does the work, none too successfully. And God appears to him again and says, here are 10 commandments. Take them back down to my people. They will ignore them. Good luck. And right? And so for Moses, God was always present because God hit Moses between the eyes. I've had maybe 5 times in my life that I knew God was speaking to me. And that's enough. In fact, in my experience, I never like to ask God to speak to me. I never ask God to be present to me and reveal God's own self to me because it is too painful. It's too frightening. It's too overwhelming. I don't think I can take it but once every 10 or 20 years. Moses realized that to look face to face on God would be to die. And all he could do was bow his head. And I understand what Moses was feeling. And so my way of doing religion, my way of being a spiritual leader, is very different than most ministers, and I know it throws people that come to this church, they think I'm not very religious. I'm not in that sense. But God is always present. One of my great frustrations in the ministry is to realize that I cannot explain this. And no matter how hard I try in preaching or teaching, there's no way to convey that experience of God. You can only experience it by experiencing it. I can't describe it to you. I can't tell you how to get there. I can't give you 4 simple steps to see a burning bush. God has to light the bush. And so I've never felt I could begin to convey in worship or in preaching the essence of my relationship with God, because I don't use conventional language or the normal tools for it. God called me when I was 6 to be a minister. That was reaffirmed when I was 13. I stayed in the ministry because of a burning bush when I was 28. God spoke to me again when I was 50. And that's about all I can handle. Because we're not talking about, we're not talking about picking up a battery. We're talking about a 30,000 volt power line. If I never experience God's presence again in this lifetime, it'd be okay. If you can experience God once in your life, you're blessed. So I've come to realize that, yeah, I'm not very religious. I'm not sure I would approve me to be a minister if I was on the board of the ministry. Yet, God has called me with that sense of humor that takes an introvert who doesn't have the right tools to be a pastor and says, well, you're going to stand up in front of hundreds of people every week and work with dozens of people all through the week, leading them in something you don't know anything about, trying to explain a religious experience that you can't communicate. Good luck. That's the way God does it. Now, I'm going to be retiring this month, not from ministry, but from getting paid for it. I will always be a minister. That call continues. It'll just take different forms. I hope and pray it involves no more 5:30 meetings. My great goal in life is to never again have a 5:30 meeting. But you don't retire from sensing the presence of God. That's always there. I pray for you, in your own way, with your own personality, with your own background, with your own style, to experience God. And it may be entirely different from mine. In fact, I hope it's entirely different than mine, because there are many things you can do to put yourself in a closer relationship to God. And there are ways that I think make more sense to more people. But, hey, God uses me the way God uses me. I didn't get a choice in that. So, the thing I've learned most from this church is that you love me. And that you have been patient with me, put up with me. I've learned patience. One of the things I've realized in this church, one of the great benefits of being in one church 34 years, as opposed to moving every 4 years, is that people grow and change and they come back. And my first day in the ministry, I was told somebody was going to leave my church, and they did. And that's just a fact of life in churches and with preachers. And the blessing of being here 34 years is I've seen so many people that left for whatever reasons come back. I don't think it's not because of me, it's because of this church. This is a community church that reaches out to the whole community. And sooner or later, people say, well, he's not going away, I might as well go back. And they do, and it's good. It's good. I guess the final lesson I've learned is that God, who plays practical jokes, puts into every church and every pastor's life some people that you're glad to see leave. And often they don't. So we wish they'd leave. You know, they're irritating. They're just terrible, terrible. But one of the things I realized after a few years here, I realized I wanted to stay here a long time. And it eventually dawned on me that if I was going to stay here a long time, and that stinking so-and-so was going to stay here a long time, we were going to have to learn how to live together. I couldn't wait for them to leave, and they couldn't wait for me to leave. We were both here. And the amazing thing is that if you put up with each other long enough, you grow to love each other. In 1990, I preached a sermon in which I questioned the wisdom of going to war in Iraq. And I got a really angry letter from a man I didn't know who he was. He's one of our season, one of these people that comes on the weekends from Orlando. I'd never heard the name. Very angry letter about my position. So I wrote him back and told him why I was right. He wrote me back and told me why he was right. Turned out he was a retired Marine Corps colonel. And we wrote back and forth arguing back and forth, eventually he and his son, who was also a retired Marine Corps colonel, went to the Holy Land with me. I officiated at the 50th wedding anniversary renewal of vows for him and his wife and helped him stand up there because he was blubbering like a baby. And I myself cried at his funeral. We became dear friends. We never did agree on the war in Iraq, but you know, it doesn't matter. We grew to love each other. And that's what I have learned by being here 34 years, that people leave for God only knows which reasons. And so many of them come back for God only knows which reasons. And as much as I'd like to dislike some people permanently, God, the practical jokester, makes me love them. And so some of you it's really easy to love. Some of you it's been a trip. But God, who is the reality behind it all, brings us together. And so mostly what I've learned is that I love you. Thank you. It says here we're supposed to sing a hymn. What we're going to do, we're going to sing a hymn. I'm going to say the benediction. Then you can, I'll close my eyes for 10 seconds. You can gracefully slip out and leave, because then Staff Parish has got some things they want to do. And after they've done their worst, or their best, or whatever, then we'll sing the Go Now in Peace, okay? So let's stand to sing.